prior to joining the FBI. Bogart said, "That's a good idea, Alex. You might be right." "We can certainly check," said Milligan. "Even with patient confidentiality, we can get his wife to contact them and see if Dabney was there." Bogart said, "Todd, get going on that. If he knew he was terminal over a month ago, it might provide some motivation to do what he did, meaning kill Berkshire." Milligan rose and hurried from the room.
"Meaning he would never be tried for the crime,"
Jameson said to Bogart.
"Right.
But it still won't explain why he killed Berkshire," Decker pointed out.
"No, but it'll fill in one more piece of the puzzle, and it may help us answer that question at some point. And the ME got back to us on the blood screens. Dabney was taking painkillers, which reinforces the notion that he knew he was sick."
Decker rose.
"Where are you going?" asked Bogart.
"For a walk." He started at the cafe. After a full breakfast at home, Dabney had stopped here, sat at a table overlooking the street, then got up, walked out and down the street, and shot Berkshire in the head before putting a round in his own brain. As Decker was sitting there, the same female employee he had spoken to earlier came over.
"I saw you in here earlier with that woman. You guys still looking into what happened?"
"Still looking," said Decker absently.
"I guess it doesn't matter much."
He shot her a look. "What doesn't matter much?"
"Billy's in today. I gave him the card you left, but I don't know if he ever called you guys. He was working when that man was here. If you want to talk to him, he's not busy right now."
"I do want to talk to him." She left and came back with a tall, middle-aged man with graying hair worn in a ponytail. He had on a black shirt like the woman wore and faded jeans. A green apron was tied around his waist.
"Hey," said Billy, as the woman went back to the counter. "I hear you're with the FBI. You want to ask me some stuff?"
"Yeah, you want to take a seat?" Billy sat across from him. "You work here long?" asked Decker. Billy laughed.
"Back in 2008, I was an investment banker, if you can believe it. Then came financial Armageddon, and I got tossed out on my ass. Lost everything. So I said to hell with it, never looked back. I've been working here 4 years. I can barely rub two dimes together, but I'm happier than I've ever been."
"Good for you. You remember Dabney?"
"Yeah, he came in that morning."
"Had he ever come in before?"
"No, at least not that I saw. Now that I've seen his picture in the paper and on the TV, I think I would have remembered."
"He sat at this table?"
"Yeah. I passed by a couple times with some orders. Funny thing is, he didn't eat a bite of his scone. I actually asked him if something was wrong with it."
Decker tensed. "Wait a minute, you talked to him?"
"Well, yeah. The dude wasn't drinking his tea, and the scone thing caught my eye. They're really good, and they're not cheap. And the guy hadn't touched it."
"What did you say to him?"
"Asked him if the scone was cold or something. Told him I could heat it up for him if he wanted. Get him some butter."
"What did he say?"
"He said he didn't have much of an appetite. Weird, huh, since he had just ordered it."
"Yeah," said Decker. "But apparently he was a weird guy." Billy chuckled.
"Right, the whole murder thing. That is weird."
"Right," said Decker dryly.
"Anyway, he got really focused on something outside the window."
Decker tensed once more. "What do you mean, focused?"
"I mean, he straightened up so fast he almost knocked his tea off the table. He was looking right past me. Next thing he was on his feet and out the door. Almost forgot his briefcase. In fact, I called out to him about it. Otherwise, he would have left it behind."
"And if he had, Ann Berkshire would be alive right now," thought Decker.
"So I cleaned the table off. Thought about putting the scone back behind the counter, but we have rules about that. So I just threw it away."
"Anything else?"
"No. I guess I should have called you guys. Amy gave me the card, but I've been off and just chilling."
When Decker said nothing, he added,
"You want anything to eat or drink? I can warm a scone up for you."
"I'm good, thanks."
"You sure?"
Decker didn't answer. He was staring out the window. Billy finally got up and left. From this vantage point, Decker could see pretty far down the street. He closed his eyes and clicked through mental frames until he got to the series he wanted. He traced every footstep that he had seen Dabney and Berkshire take. The timing here was critical, but he didn't have all the information he needed to make an accurate analysis. But still, he had to try. Step by step. Decker wasn't focused on the end of their respective walks, which had led to Berkshire's death and Dabney's mortal wound. He opened his eyes and peered down the street. He was fairly certain of one thing. The catalyst that had prompted Dabney to tense and stare out the window, as Billy had described, could not have been his seeing Berkshire. It just wasn't possible from this vantage point. She would have been much farther down the street at that time and out of sight from this spot. So what had the catalyst been? And then it occurred to Decker. He got up and went outside and stood on the other side of the window. No phone had been found on Dabney, so it wasn't an electronic communication. Since this had been planned out and Dabney was not supposed to survive, they could not use the phone. It would leave a trail, even if he tried to erase it. And perhaps whoever he was working with could not completely trust him to do that. But there was one signaling device that left no trail. There had been someone out on the street that Dabney had seen, and that person's presence had been the signal. Perhaps it was the clothing the person wore, a gesture made, but something had triggered his abrupt departure from the cafe. And that also explained the untouched tea and uneaten scone. The cafe was simply the place for him to wait for the signal. And it was clear what the person would be signaling. That Anne Berkshire was on her way. Decker crossed the street and walked down the pavement. He was tracing the route he had taken, and also the one Dabney had navigated. He turned his head from side to side, taking everything in, and comparing it to what he had seen on the day of the shooting. The construction barrier that had been there earlier around the open manhole cover was gone, but everything else looked the same. He passed the guard shack and kept going. Up ahead would have been Dabney. In his mind's eye, Decker placed the dead man on the street, walking. Then there was Berkshire, coming from the other way. Decker had had no reason to focus on her, but he pulled up the memory frames he did have of her to see what he could make of it. He had been too far away to really see her face, so he couldn't tell her expression. He did remember that she was not walking like Dabney had been, with long, confident strides. The man walking the last mile to his death. The pair had moved closer. They had eventually turned, Dabney to the left and Berkshire to the right. Then, like two passenger trains aligned on parallel tracks, they had drawn nearly shoulder to shoulder. That's when Decker had looked away to the food truck to decide whether or not to buy a breakfast burrito. He had checked his watch, opted not to, and turned back. By then the gun was out and pointed at the base of Berkshire's neck. Then the shot rang out. She dropped to the pavement, dead. The guard came running up. They confronted Dabney. He shot himself. Memory frames over. Decker stood there in the middle of the sidewalk as people walked past on either side of him. He stared down where there were still minute traces of blood from the two dead people. Then he looked up and wondered what had happened to the person who had possibly signaled to Dabney.
So that's where you went.
He turned to see Jameson standing there.
Milligan called Mrs. Dabney, and she in turn called M.D. Anderson. I was right. Walter Dabney did go there, where his brain cancer was diagnosed. He had told the hospital he was not going to seek treatment.
When Decker didn't react to any of this, she said,
What is it? You got something? You usually do after wandering around alone.
We need to get the camera feeds from this area for that day.
But we know what happened here, Decker.
No, we really don't. Chapter 26. It wasn't the cliché of the lady in red. It wasn't even a lady. At least it didn't appear to be, but it was impossible to tell. Decker sat there and stared at the person holding a giant lollipop while wearing a clown suit.
You really think that's it? The signal? Asked Bogart.
We looked at 6 days' worth of film, said Decker. Did you ever see a clown in any of the others at that location at that time of day? and we made inquiries, and no one could account for why the clown was there. No circus or other show in town. The clown had no sign advertising an upcoming event. I think the probabilities are the clown was the signal. Bogart glanced at Milligan. They were once more at the WFO, in a small room where an enormous TV screen dominated one wall.
You're probably right, Bogart admitted.
Jameson said,
And the clown disappeared around the building only after he had a clear sightline of Dabney. In other words, after it was confirmed that Dabney had gotten the signal and was on his way to kill Berkshire.
Bogart sighed. And the clown was wearing makeup and a floppy hat and bulky clothes and gloves. I couldn't even tell if he was black or white. I couldn't say for sure whether he was actually a male. Milligan said, And we've checked other cameras from the areas where the clown was headed. He or she is on some of them, but then there's a gap, and the person's gone.
The clown obviously knew where the cameras and the gaps were, opined Bogart. A well-thought-out plan.
So there's a conspiracy going on here,
said Jameson.
These people got Dabney to kill Berkshire, and since he was already dying, he killed himself.
Bogart said, But how did they get him to do that? According to Agent Brown, the gambling debts were paid off. The Russians or whoever it was had no incentive to do this. And Brown also said that she didn't think the mob would be involved in this. They just wanted the money. And having worked on some of those cases, I agree with her. Milligan said, So again, how did whoever it was get him to do it? Jameson looked at Decker.
Do you know?
Decker didn't say anything right away. His mind was worrying, and facts and suspicions were crowding in on one another, threatening to cancel each other out. He said, Dabney stole secrets from military projects he was working on. DIA found that out. He paused. If they found it out, others could have too. Bogart said,
And you mean blackmailed him with evidence of his treason to kill Berkshire?
It would help explain the fact that we have as yet been unable to establish a link between Dabney and Berkshire. They may have no connection.
It's sort of like strangers on a train, said Milligan.
But just one way. They blackmailed Dabney to kill someone they want done away with for their own reasons.
But why would he do it?
Asked Jameson.
The guy was dying. Why would he care if what he did came out?
He might have been dying, but his family wasn't, replied Decker. And from the interactions we've had with his wife and daughters, it's quite clear that they thought the man walked on water. The fact that he was dying might have made it easier for him. He knew he'd never go to trial on this, and he might have hoped that his actions would be blamed on his illness.
But if he were unmasked as a spy, said Bogart,
then he would have no way around that, said Decker. His career would end in disgrace, and he might take his daughter down with him. If he kills Berkshire and then himself, maybe he hoped everyone would focus on that. He might not have known the DIA was on to him. But if someone was blackmailing him, they would have him dead to rights. That might have been enough for him to take the deal. But how could Dabney be sure, if he carried out the killing, that they'd live up to their part of the bargain and not reveal the espionage part? Asked Milligan. I'm not sure he had much of a choice. But if they did try to reveal that information, it might somehow draw focus on them. And why would they care if the espionage ever came to light? Dabney was already dead, and people who blackmail other people to murder aren't necessarily altruistic. For all we know, they're actually enemies of this country. No, they would have every incentive to keep mum so that our side wouldn't even know the theft had occurred. Dabney probably figured the same thing. Milligan said, So, he kills Berkshire and himself. That means the blackmailer is out there still. Jameson said,
Other things being equal, it might be someone Dabney was working with. Otherwise, how would they know he was stealing secrets?
Could be, said Bogart. But there are also lots of ways someone he wasn't working with might have gained access to that knowledge.
Decker said, Which leads us to the question of why this third party would want Ann Berkshire dead in the first place.
So now, instead of a connection between Dabney and Berkshire, we need to try to find one between Dabney and this unknown blackmailing third party? Said Milligan, frowning.
But the third party must have some connection to Berkshire, too, since they wanted her dead.
Decker nodded.
That's exactly right.
Bogart said,
Where do we start?
Well, as Alex and Todd suggested, the blackmailer had to have some connection to Dabney and Berkshire, however extenuated, even if Dabney and Berkshire didn't know each other. The third party would be the conduit between them. They had to know about the theft of secrets, and they had to communicate with Dabney. They hopefully left enough of a trail for us to follow.
So we have to go back to square one, said Milligan wearily.
There are a couple of ways to attack this, said Decker. One is the Berkshire angle. If someone wanted her dead, there's a good reason. That reason may lie in her exceptionally sketchy past. So we may be able to track down the blackmailer by digging more deeply into Berkshire's history.
And the other way?
Asked Jameson. Dabney, you're not going to agree to kill someone without persuasion. And that sort of persuasion isn't going to come in a tweet, text, or email, because I doubt anyone would write something like that down. So there had to be meetings with Dabney. We just have to find who they were with.
Bogart said, Why don't Todd and I run that angle down? You and Jameson can hit it from the Berkshire end. Jameson nodded.
And we can compare notes along the way to see where we stand. Sound like a good plan, Decker?
Decker sat there staring off.
Amos, I said, does that sound like a good plan?
Decker finally stirred and looked at her as though he had just realized she was in the room. He said slowly, I don't know, Alex. I don't know if anything sounds like a good plan right now. Chapter 27. When Decker and Jameson got home that night, someone was waiting for them. Danny Amaya looked pale and nervous. Jameson said,
Danny, what's wrong? It's my dad. He didn't pick me up from school today. How did you get home? A friend's mom drove me here. Have you called the police? No, I didn't know what to do. I was scared. It'll be okay, Danny. We'll come up with something.
Jameson took his hand and led him up to their apartment.
Are you hungry?
She said. He nodded, glancing anxiously at Decker.
I'll make you something to eat. Now, Danny, tell us anything you can that might help us find out where your dad is.
Jameson got busy in the kitchen, and Danny sat at the bar watching her while Decker stood behind him.
He dropped me at school today, like always.
Did he say anything to you then that might explain why he didn't show up to get you later? Asked Decker.
No, not that I can think of. I go to aftercare, and Dad is always there by 6. But when he didn't show up, I didn't know what to do. Do you have a phone?
Asked Jameson. Danny shook his head.
My dad has one, but it's too expensive for me to have one, too. But couldn't you use a friend's phone to call your dad? I did. I borrowed a phone and called, but no one answered.
Jameson said,
Okay. For now, we're going to call the police, and they can start looking for your father.
Decker said, I can go over to the construction site where he works. You told us where it is, near the waterfront. Danny nodded. Jameson stopped slicing up a tomato for a salad she was making and said,
Decker, you shouldn't go alone.
I'm not going to do anything dangerous. I'm just going to take a look at the place, that's all. If I see anything suspicious, I'll call the cops. He held out his hand. I'll have to take your car, Alex. She drew the keys from her jacket pocket, but hesitated handing them over.
You promise nothing dangerous?
Promise. Decker looked at Danny. What exactly does your father do, Danny, at the construction site?
Lots of things. He's a bricklayer, mostly. He's really good at it.
I'll be back shortly.
A minute later, Decker wedged himself into Jameson's car and drove off. It only took about 15 minutes to reach the construction site. It was well dark now, and Decker couldn't see anyone around. The buildings on either side of his destination looked to be in the process of being torn down. This whole area was undergoing a vast renovation. A chilly wind whistled in between buildings. Decker parked on the street across from the site and drew up the collar of his jacket. He took a minute to look all around. He still didn't see anyone, and he also didn't see Amaya's Sentra parked anywhere. He jogged across the street and stood in front of the unfinished building. The exterior walls were up, and the concrete floors had been poured. Decker counted 12 floors. Construction elevators were grafted to the concrete skeleton like tendons on bone. He maneuvered through some barriers, stepped through an opening, and stared around at the empty first floor.
He was very surprised there were no security guards on site here. He put one hand on his pistol and pulled a flashlight from his other pocket. He shone it around, but saw nothing except stacks of construction material. He glimpsed a set of steps leading down to the floors below ground. He debated whether to do this, but decided he had to. For all he knew, Amaya might be down there, hurt or even dead. He walked down the steps and reached the lower floor. He pointed his light around and saw that the space here was partially completed. There was a hole in the floor in the far corner, and stacks of bricks set against one wall. When he looked down, he saw that the floor was mortared, bricklaid, over a concrete slab. The next moment, he heard a noise and killed his light. He moved to a corner and listened. He thought he heard voices, but he couldn't make out any words. Then came footsteps. Then came a light. Decker moved back farther into the shadows. Four men appeared on the stairs. They were carrying something. When Decker saw what it was, his hand went to his phone. It was clearly a body. They carried it over next to the hole and set it down. Then a light one of the men was holding flicked around the space. That's when Decker saw a very nervous-looking Tomas Amaya. His face was bruised and bloody. Two of the men had guns out. They pointed them at Amaya, and he and the fourth man lifted the body and placed it into the hole. Preparar el hormigón. Decker's Spanish wasn't that good, but he didn't need it to be. Amaya lifted up a bag of cement mix, cut it open, and poured it into a portable mixer. He added water and turned the machine on. Meanwhile, the other man had taken the body and dumped it into the hole. It was now clear what was going to happen and why they needed Amaya. He was going to put the concrete in the hole and then brick it over, seamlessly matching, no doubt, the work he had already done here. That was why they wanted him. To hide the body. And Decker didn't think the bricklayer was going to live to work on another job after this one. Decker took out his phone and saw with dismay that down here he had no service. Shit. And then he realized there was another person down here with him. Because that person had just stuck a gun muzzle in his back. Chapter 28. Decker was shoved forward, stumbled, nearly lost his balance, and then regained his footing. A light hit him in the face. Traerlo aquí. Decker was shoved in the back again. Move! He reached the hole and stared down, saw the body, and then looked over at his captors. There were five of them, plus Amaya. They were young, tough-looking, and all of them were armed. Decker did not like these odds at all. He wondered for a moment about Jameson's reaction to his being dead.
Told you so, Amos.
But he actually knew it would not be that. She would be devastated, and right now that made him feel worse than the imminent danger he was in. The little man he had seen at the apartment building was not among the five. Danny had said he had seen the man in a suit with a hard hat. Apparently, the actual murder and hiding the body part was not within his job description. And that was probably why no security guards were posted here tonight. They didn't want anyone around for this little extra task. But the other men here seemed more than prepared to do the burial honors. One of the men looked at Amaya and said, "Espacio para dos." Decker didn't need to be fluent in Spanish to understand that order either. The dos part was all he required. He was the spare, and they were going to bury him along with the other guy. He had something going for him, however long the odds would still be against him. They hadn't searched him for a weapon. That was a mistake. Yet there was a guy behind him with a gun, and the guy holding the light had a gun in his other hand. Both were pointed right at Decker. And there were three others there, all with weapons. He could maybe take out one or two, but after that, one of the others would be able to kill him. It was simple math, and he came up short in every scenario that flashed through his mind. "Él es un federale," said Amaya suddenly, pointing at Decker. The men turned to stare at him. "Es un federale," Amaya said again. "FBI." He pointed feverishly at Decker. The man holding the flashlight took a step toward Decker.
Federale?
Decker nodded. The man smiled.
I don't give a shit. You're dead.
Decker had no choice now. He didn't care if the odds were not in his favor. If he was going to die, he was going to take at least one of the pricks with him. He lowered his shoulder, dropped into a squat, and exploded out of it. He drilled the guy right in the sternum, maxing out the thrust from his legs. He hit the man so hard he was lifted off his feet, flew backward, and with a scream fell into the hole. Now Decker's problem was obvious. There were four other guys to deal with. The good thing was the only light had just disappeared into the hole. Darkness was his best friend right now. Gunfire erupted all around. Fortunately, Decker had dropped to the floor an instant before, pulled his gun, and was about to fire when he saw something flash past him so fast he couldn't even tell what it was. But he did hear the impact as body met body and one of them gave. He next heard the clunk of something hitting the brick floor hard. He rolled to his right, aimed his gun, and fired. The man who had jammed his gun into Decker's back caught the round in his belly. He doubled over, screaming, and a few moments later, blood came out of his mouth. He dropped to the floor and out of the fight. Belly wounds were a bitch, Decker knew. The guy would probably bleed out right there, and he could not have cared less. Shots hit the floor near him. He could sense chips of concrete and brick whizzing through the air. And then he felt something cut into his arm. Either a slug or a chip. Either way, it hurt like hell. He kept rolling along the floor as more shots were fired. He ran into something, realized it was a wall, rose, pivoted, and went into a crouch. He focused on the situation. By his count, three down, two to go. As he spun around, trying to gauge where the remaining two were, he sensed another flash of something, resulting in another collision. He heard a muffled scream and a gun hit the brick, followed by a body doing the same thing. Okay, there was only one man left. He liked these odds a lot better. He crept forward, his gun ready, when he saw Tomas Amaya struggling with the last man. The guy had a gun. He was bigger and stronger than Amaya. He threw the smaller man off, took aim, and started to squeeze the trigger. Decker was about to fire when the other man was hit so hard he was lifted off his feet. Whoever hit him was holding on, and when the guy slammed into the brick, the gun fell from his hand. Okay, fifth and final man down for the count. It was pretty much unbelievable. Decker moved forward, panting slightly, his pistol held out in front of him. He swung it around, looking for movement, looking for additional threats. Someone was still out there, and though he had attacked the other guys, he hadn't done anything to identify himself to Decker either. So he could still be a problem. The next moment, Decker saw a pop of light. Then he saw a hand grip the side of the hole and looked over as a head emerged. It was the guy he had knocked into the hole. He had the flashlight clamped in his mouth. His other hand came up, and it held a gun pointed right at Decker. There was no way Decker could react in time. He started to bring his gun around, but he instinctively braced for the impact of the shot. Then a work boot came down hard on the man's free hand. He screamed. Then the same boot kicked the gun out of his hand. The man let go and fell back into the hole, while the gun dropped harmlessly to the floor. Decker eyed Amaya, who stood next to the hole, breathing hard. Thanks, said Decker. A pale Amaya nodded, obviously too shaken to even attempt a response. He staggered away from the hole and sat down on the floor.
Damn, man, can you never stay out of trouble?
Decker whirled around and stared over at the source of the query. A light came on. It was pointed away from Decker and toward the person holding it. Melvin Mars, bent over and breathing hard, smiled and said, "See, Decker, sometimes Hail Marys do work." Chapter 29. Nice place. Melvin Mars, nearly 6'3" and 230 muscled pounds, stood in the middle of Jameson's and Decker's kitchen, looking around. He was a former All-American running back from Texas, a sure lock for the NFL, who had been falsely imprisoned for murdering his parents and sentenced to death. After 20 years in jail and on the eve of his execution date, someone else had confessed to the crime. That had led to Decker and his FBI team's involvement and the truth eventually coming out. The state of Texas and the federal government had chipped in on an enormous payday for Mars, allowing him financial independence for the rest of his life. Jameson smiled up at Mars.
Hey, it was your wallet that provided it.
The local police had been called to the construction site and taken over the investigation, or mess, rather. The guy Decker had shot was dead, and the other three, handled by Mars, were still unconscious but alive. The fifth man, the one in the hole, was identified as Roger Baker, a low-level enforcer for a local gang. The other men there were part of his crew. The body in the hole was identified as Mateo Rodriguez, an accountant who, they had been told, was working with law enforcement to bring down the local roots of a Central American cartel that had muscled its way into the D.C. area. They were still looking for Luis Alvarez, the man in the suit and hard hat. He had been one of the construction supervisors, but allegedly had criminal ties. He had disappeared, but the police were hopeful they could track him down. Danny and his father had been reunited and taken to live somewhere else. Tomas Amaya would need to testify at the trial of Roger Baker. They were hoping that Baker, in turn, would rat on others farther up the line. Jameson and Decker had told the Amayas that they would help them every step of the way.
I'll be by to check on you both,
Jameson had told Danny before they were taken away by the police.
And don't worry, everything is going to be okay now.
The police had kept them for hours, so it was now around 6 in the morning. Mars had driven Decker home. Decker was sitting at the kitchen table, still looking a little pale. Mars eyed him. Man, it was hairy in there. I can hold my own in pretty much any fight, but those dudes had some serious firepower. Good thing Alex told me where you were. I got in from the airport about 10 minutes after you left. I drove my rental car right over to the place, looked around, and then heard all the noise from the basement. When I got down there, it wasn't looking too good. You saved my life, Melvin, said Decker. I'd be under a slab of concrete now but for you. Payback, man. How many times did you save my butt? Besides, I just treated it like running plays. Blow through the line and deliver some hurt. He looked at Jameson. You're doing good work with him, Alex. He's even skinnier than when I saw him last time. Jameson did not appear to be listening.
Amos, you told me you weren't going to do anything dangerous. You almost got yourself and Melvin killed.
Look, I'm sorry, but something was obviously going down in there.
Then you should have called the police, like you told me you were going to.
Well, you shouldn't have given Melvin the address. Then he wouldn't have come. Hey, man, don't get mad at her. I made her do it. Had to make sure you were okay. Decker looked at Jameson, who was still scowling at him.
Because he's your friend, Amos. Friends don't put other friends' lives in jeopardy.
Okay, Alex. Message delivered, loud and clear.
Has it been, really? What, until next time you ignore it?
No one said anything for a long moment. Finally, Decker turned to Mars and said, How are things in Alabama? Mars sat down on one of the bar stools and Jameson poured him out a cup of coffee, though it was easy to see that she was still upset at Decker. Not bad. I did my thing with the high school football team and then decided to take some time off.
Are you living down there?
Jameson asked tersely. Had a short-term rental. I'm looking around now to find a permanent place, maybe somewhere up here. He glanced at Decker. How about that, Decker? Me living up here. You can live wherever you want, Melvin, Decker answered. You can buy a mansion if you want. Grinning, Mars said, I spent 20 years in a little box. What would I do with a mansion? I'd get lost.
There are a lot of nice places around here,
said Jameson.
And it's a fun area, lots to do.
Mars sipped his coffee. So you guys working on something? I mean, besides what happened last night.
If Decker doesn't go off and get killed, yeah, we are working on something,
said Jameson, with one more glare at Decker.
And it's pretty complicated. We haven't made a lot of headway.
Mars motioned to Decker.
That dude's middle name is complicated. What he can't figure out can't be figured out.
Well, this might be the one, said Decker, heaving himself to his feet and plopping down on a stool next to Mars.
Want to tell me about it? Asked Mars.
You heard about the guy who shot the woman outside the FBI headquarters?
Asked Jameson. Yeah, saw the story a few days ago on CNN when I was having lunch. Saw some more stuff when I was waiting at the airport.
Well, that's the case.
We know part of what happened, said Decker, but we don't know why Walter Dabney shot Ann Berkshire.
We think he was blackmailed by someone to do it.
Blackmailed? How?
This is confidential, Melvin,
said Jameson.
He chuckled. Hey, who do you think I'm going to tell? Hell, I don't know anybody to tell.
Decker said, apparently Dabney was stealing secrets from a military project he was working on. He sold those secrets to raise money to help his daughter. Her husband was into some bad guys for gambling debts. Russians. It was either pay or get slaughtered.
Damn, so this Dabney guy was caught between a rock and a hard place?
He committed treason, Melvin,
said Jameson.
Yeah, but it was his family, Alex. Tough to turn your back on that.
So that part we know, said Decker. What we don't know is the Berkshire piece. We can't find a connection between them. But there may not be one if he was blackmailed to do it. Which means we have to try to get there from Berkshire's side and the people who wanted her dead.
Bogart and Milligan are tackling it from Dabney's end,
interjected Jameson.
And Dabney shot himself, right?
Yes, but he had terminal brain cancer,
said Jameson.
He'd be dead in 6 months or less, so maybe he didn't care.
Mars frowned and slowly shook his head.
Wow. Blackmail, gambling debts, brain tumor. This Dabney guy had a dark cloud over him.
It is pretty sad,
said Jameson.
You think you're having a bad day? Think about what happened to him. His family is devastated.
What about the daughter whose husband got him into this mess? Said Mars.
What about her?
Asked Jameson.
Well, she must feel pretty bad.
She does. We've seen that firsthand.
Yeah, I get that. But what about something her old man might have told her?
Told her about what?
Well, I take it this whole gambling thing was a secret between them.
It was, said Decker. His wife didn't know anything about it. Neither did the sisters. At least so they claimed.
So maybe he had a closer relationship with his daughter. Parents do, you know, have that special thing with certain kids. And if he did something illegal to help her, and then he gets blackmailed to do something else bad, he might have talked to her about it.
Why?
Asked Jameson.
Because he'd want her to know why he did what he did. He wouldn't want her to think he was some kind of crazy murderer. If they were blackmailing him for stealing secrets that he stole and sold to help her, I think he'd want her to know.
Mars looked between Decker and Jameson.
Hey, just my 2 cents.
Jameson stared at Decker.
But didn't Agent Brown say that Natalie knew nothing about what her dad was planning in the way of stealing secrets to pay for the gambling debts?
She did, but there's no way she could know that for sure. I'm not sure she even talked to her.
But if Natalie and her dad communicated via phone or email or text, there'd be a record of it.
But what about face-to-face? We checked on Dabney's travel schedule. We never looked at Natalie's.
So you mean she could have come here? Or met up with him somewhere?
Decker looked at her. If you were sick and suspected what was wrong, would you go to MD Anderson or any hospital alone? Or would you want a family member with you?
I'd want someone with me,
replied Jameson.
But why not his wife?
Maybe he didn't want to freak her out. She seems the nervous type. And if he was closer to Natalie, like Melvin suggested, she might have gone with him. I mean, she owed him big for saving her husband's butt.
Jameson said,
we never asked the hospital if someone was with him. But do you really think Natalie might know who was blackmailing her father?
If there's even a remote possibility that she does, or has information that could lead us to whoever it is, we have to follow it up.
But Decker, Agent Brown told us that Natalie...
He snapped. I know what Agent Brown told us. That doesn't make it true.
But we're working the Berkshire angle. Ross and Todd are doing the Dabney side of the equation.
I don't care who's doing what, Alex. I go wherever a case takes me.
Decker rose. Jameson looked at her watch.
What, you mean go now? It's not even 6:30 yet.
The next moment, Decker was out the door without responding. With twinkling eyes, Mars looked at Jameson and said,
Dude doesn't change, does he?
That's the problem, Melvin,
retorted Jameson. Chapter 30. It was nearly 7 o'clock when they arrived at the Dabney home. A couple of cars were in the circular driveway. They were probably rentals being used by the daughters while they were here. The house looked dark, with only the front porch light on. Mars had come with them. They had driven over in his car because Jameson's would barely fit her and Decker. But he waited in the car while they walked up to the house. Decker knocked on the front door. No one came.
Do you think the housekeeper's here yet?
Asked Jameson. I don't know anything about housekeepers, said Decker. They turned toward the door when they heard footsteps. Jules Dabney opened the door. She was dressed in sweatpants and a GW sweatshirt. Her hair was tied back in a ponytail, and she was barefoot. She looked at them and said crossly,
Jesus, it's a little early, you know.
Is your sister Natalie here? Asked Decker.
Yes, but she's asleep.
We need to talk to her.
Can't this wait?
If it could, we wouldn't be here this early.
Look, I'm going to have to insist.
Decker held out his creds and said, We need to talk to her. Jameson stepped in front of him.
Just tell your sister that we want to talk to her about Corbett.
Corbett? Is he okay?
Just tell her. If she still doesn't want to talk to us, we'll leave and come back later.
Jules hesitated and then closed the door. They heard her walking away. As they were standing there waiting, a small Kia SUV pulled up and parked off the main drive. The housekeeper, an older black woman whom Decker and Jameson had seen on a previous visit, got out of the car and walked past them, nodding and smiling. She opened the front door with a key and went in. Jameson looked at her watch.
Okay, now we know. Housekeepers to the rich get in at 7 sharp.
Another few minutes passed, and when the door opened again, it was Natalie. She had on an ankle-length robe. Her hair was stringy and matted on one side. Her eyes were bloodshot.
Jules said you wanted to talk about Corbett. Maybe we can come inside?
Suggested Jameson.
I guess,
she said sullenly. She stepped back and they walked past her. She led them to the library and closed the door behind them. They sat on the couch and she sat across from them. Natalie wouldn't look at them. Her gaze remained directed at the floor.
My mom's not up yet. That's okay. We don't need to bother her,
said Jameson. She glanced at Decker. He said, We know about the gambling debts, and we know how your father got the money to pay them off.
Oh, God.
Natalie put her face in her hands and started sobbing. Jameson rose, crossed the room, and sat down next to her, wrapping an arm around her quaking body. She gave Decker a scowl. Natalie started to gasp for air.
Are you okay?
Asked Jameson. Natalie reached into her pocket and pulled out an inhaler. She took 2 quick puffs, and her breathing rapidly settled down.
I'm okay now. Asthma,
she added, holding up the inhaler.
We all have it, except Dad. We got it from Mom.
She leaned back against her chair and closed her eyes, breathing deeply. Jameson sat back next to Decker and whispered,
I think you need to go a little easy.
Decker waited for Natalie to regain her composure. She slowly sat up, rubbed her eyes dry with the cord of her robe, and looked at him.
I didn't know who else to turn to,
she said, her voice scratchy and raw.
They were going to kill him. They were going to kill all of us.
Did you know about the gambling? Asked Decker.
I didn't know the extent of it, and I didn't know he was mixed up with the sort of people who would murder you. Are you sure he's not going to do it again?
Asked Jameson.
This scared the shit out of Corbett. But at this point, I don't really care. I'm divorcing him. He cost me my father. I hate him. I hate everything about him. I'm coming back to the States with my daughter. I just have to find a place to live.
Do you know where your father got the money?
She shook her head.
I know he and Mom were well off, but the amount was so huge.
10 million, we heard, said Decker. She nodded.
I didn't think they had that kind of money in cash. But maybe if they sold the house and some other stuff.
Decker said, And you were expecting your father to do that? Sell everything they had? Everything they'd worked for?
I don't know. I don't know what I was expecting him to do, I guess.
She paused.
When I was a kid and got into trouble, my father always fixed things. Always. He made things right, I guess. I guess I got used to that.
Decker said firmly, That works with falling off your bike and getting your feelings hurt when someone calls you a name. But you're not a kid anymore, Natalie. She gazed fixedly at him.
I know that. I don't need a lecture from the FBI, okay?
So he said nothing to you about where he was going to get the money?
No. He just told me he'd take care of it.
How was the money sent?
Asked Jameson.
I think he had it wired, but I'm not sure. I just know that it was received, Corbett told me. He was so relieved.
I'm sure, said Decker harshly. So when you heard about your father, what did you think had happened?
I didn't know what to think. I thought maybe he had snapped or something. When Jules called, she was so calm and professional, just like she always is.
She added derisively.
But all I could make out was that Dad was dead and he had shot himself. I didn't even know about the woman he killed until I got here, although Jules said she told me. I guess I didn't process that part. I'm not as coldly efficient as my big sister.
Did you think what he did was connected to how he had gotten the money?
Asked Jameson. Natalie nodded, looking miserable as the tears rolled down her cheeks.
I thought it had to be connected, and so I believed it was my fault. I drank on the flight from France, and then when I got here, I kept drinking. I don't remember much before or after.
I'm sure that was a big help to your family, said Decker sternly.
Hey!
She snapped.
I'm not proud of what I did, okay? So you can leave the high and mighty attitude for someone else. And if you keep it up, I won't do anything to help you.
Decker leaned forward. Let me lay this out so that you see clearly what's at stake here, lady. I'm not here begging for favors. Your father committed treason to get the money to pay Corbett's damn gambling debts. Natalie went white and her mouth hung open. She looked like she might throw up. Decker ignored her expression and continued, So that makes you, at minimum, an accessory to treason, and you didn't come forward with any of this information that might have explained, in part, why your father did what he did. That's obstruction of justice. You combine the two with assorted other felonies, which any competent U.S. attorney would be able to come up with, and you won't have to worry about finding a place to live after you divorce Corbett. Your housing will be provided by the federal prison system for the rest of your life.
Oh, my God.
Before she became hysterical, Decker said, But if you cooperate, maybe that doesn't happen.
What do you want me to do?
She blurted out. Someone I greatly respect thinks your father may have told you something that might help us.
Like what?
Decker said. I'm guessing you're the youngest.
I am. How did you know?
You said your dad took care of everything for you, and you said Jules was all professional-like. She's the oldest, the take-charge one. Natalie nodded. So you and your dad had a special relationship.
We did.
You flew over here and went with him to the doctors, didn't you? Natalie said,
He called me and told me he thought he was sick. I mean, really sick. He said he hadn't told anyone else he wanted me.
She broke off and fought back a sob.
He wanted me to go with him to get a definitive diagnosis. He sent the money for the plane ticket.
So you went?
Said Jameson. She rubbed her eyes, took a tissue from her robe pocket, and blew her nose.
Yes, and they confirmed that he had stage 4 inoperable brain cancer. They said that before long he wouldn't be able to function normally.
And what did your dad say about that?
That he wasn't going to do any treatments. They would give him an extra couple of weeks or maybe a month, but he didn't want that. He was planning to tell Mom, and we talked about how he was going to break the news.
And did he talk to you about anything else he was planning to do? Asked Decker. Natalie looked at each of them before settling her gaze on Decker.
If you're asking, did he tell me that he was planning on shooting someone a month or so later and then taking his own life, that would be a no. I would never have kept quiet about that.
But did he say anything that might have hinted at what he was planning to do? It might have made no sense to you, but it could still be important. Natalie thought for a few moments. She rubbed at her eyes and said,
We were talking one night. He had called me in France out of the blue.
When was this?
About a week ago.
Go on, said Decker.
Well, he said he hadn't told Mom or the others yet, but he was still planning to. And then he said, you think you know someone for a long time, and then it turns out you don't know them at all. And then before you know it, it's too late.
Did you ask him what he meant by that?
Asked Jameson.
I did. At least I tried to. I thought he might be on some pain meds and was a little incoherent, but then before I could say anything, he told me he loved me, and then he hung up. That was the last time I ever heard from him.
She bowed her head and began to quietly sob. After a few moments, she lifted her head and said,
will all this have to come out? Will my mom and sisters have to know?
Right now, I don't see any way to keep this secret, said Decker. As they walked out, Jameson looked at Decker.
What do you make of that?
I think Walter Dabney was being quite literal. Chapter 31. They left the stricken house and Mars drove them to the WFO. On the way, Jameson said,
what did you mean that Dabney was being literal?
That someone he trusted had screwed him. I just don't know who that is. Mars shot him a glance. You mean like my old man, or who I thought was my old man? Yeah, like him.
You were sort of hard on Natalie, Decker,
said Jameson. Decker looked at her. How?
She just lost her dad, and you were busting her chops.
If she was feeling guilty, she should have been. She was the reason her father stole secrets.
But her husband,
began Jameson. You make choices, interrupted Decker. Walter Dabney would never have done what he did but for Corbett not being able to control his gambling. So the result is, the guy who should have had consequences gets off without a scratch. And the guy who should have been left to deal with his terminal cancer and die with dignity is lying on a slab at the morgue. After decades of busting his ass to give his family a great life, he'll be remembered as a traitor and a murderer.
Well, he made choices too,
countered Jameson. I don't see it the same way, said Decker. Natalie was his baby girl. What was he supposed to do?
He could have said no, answered Mars, but he didn't. I'm not saying it was an easy choice, because it wasn't. Maybe he should have called in the police or helped Natalie and her family go into hiding. Dabney obviously had connections. He could have maybe helped another way.
Decker shook his head and said, neither one of you have had a kid. I did. You'd do anything to help them. Anything. And that was all Decker would say on the drive back. Once they got to the WFO, they needed a temporary visitor's badge for Mars, but they had called ahead to Bogart, and he had taken care of it, meeting them at the front entrance.
Damn, Melvin, you look good, said Bogart.
Then he glared at Decker,
and Alex phoned me to let me know what happened last night. Decker, you took a big risk, a stupid risk. What the hell were you thinking? Oh, excuse me, it was obvious that you weren't thinking. You're lucky Melvin was there to save your butt.
I always count on a little help from my friends, said Decker.
You and the Beatles, retorted Bogart. But lightning usually doesn't strike twice.
Alex already gave me hell for it.
No reason not to pile on,
said Jameson tightly.
Then the message might actually sink in.
Bogart escorted them back to his office. When they were settled, Decker said, based on a hunch from Melvin, we spoke with Natalie, Dabney's youngest sister. He went on to tell Bogart what had happened. Bogart said thoughtfully,
so you think Dabney knew who was blackmailing him?
Decker said, but there's another piece to it. You think you know someone. The problem is, that could mean different things depending on the situation. Who was Dabney referring to?
Could be lots of possible people,
interjected Jameson. Decker nodded. That's the problem. Bogart said,
but at least it gives us a new lead to follow up.
Jameson said,
it might be someone he worked with over the years.
Decker said, well, it would be someone in a position to blackmail him now. We'll have to dig into Dabney's background more.
Where do we start?
Asked Jameson. Decker answered, at the obvious source, Walter Dabney and Associates.
Have you found out anything else?
Asked Faye Thompson, Dabney's partner they had spoken with previously.
He and Jameson were in her office. Mars had gone back to the apartment. Before he could answer, she said,
"By the way, I sent the photo of the woman in the video with Walter around the office. No one recognized her."
Decker said, "Okay, thanks. We were hoping you could help us on a line of inquiry."
"Me? How?"
"We'll need a list of all your employees and partners with particular focus on ones who have been here long term. And we'll need the same for your clients. Same focus. Long term." Thompson sat back, looking both flustered and suspicious.
"Where is all this leading?"
"Hopefully to the truth."
"Sounds more like a scattergun approach."
"Investigations like this have to look at everything," said Decker. "And we can't discount the possibility that whatever drove Walter Dabney to do what he did originated here."
"I think that's extremely unlikely."
"Nevertheless."
"Do you have a warrant?"
"Do we need one?" He cocked his head. "I would have thought you'd want us to find out the truth behind all this."
"Of course I do. But I'm also running a business, and this sort of thing can be very disruptive. And you very well know that most of what we do is classified. We can't just start breaching confidences."
"Well, we apologize for the inconvenience, but two people are dead."
"I get that, but—"
Decker interrupted her. "And there's something else."
"What?"
"Walter Dabney needed an enormous amount of money very quickly. I won't get into why, but he stole secrets from a project he was working on here and sold them to enemies of this country." Thompson slowly rose, wide-eyed, and stared down at him.
"Bullshit.
DIA has been investigating this for a while. If you don't believe me, talk to them." Thompson put a hand against the wall to steady herself.
"DIA?"
Decker nodded.
"What secrets?"
"Serious, classified stuff."
"We'll have to do an immediate internal review."
"Might be a little late for that."
"This could ruin us,"
groaned Thompson.
"The sooner we solve this thing, the better it'll be for you,"
Jameson pointed out.
"I have to talk to some people,"
said Thompson. "Okay, but if you don't want to cooperate, we can easily get a warrant," said Decker. She said quickly,
"I didn't say I wouldn't cooperate. Look, I have to check with some other partners and our lawyers. Can I at least do that?"
"Absolutely, and we can wait here while you do." She stared hard at him, but Decker's features were unflinching. She rose and picked up her phone.
"Then please excuse me while I go and do that,"
she said coldly. She left the room and slammed the door behind her.
"Do you think she's hiding something?"
asked Jameson. Decker shrugged. "Other things being equal, I think she's just pissed because this is going to hit her right in the wallet."
"Do you think it was wise to tell her about the stolen secrets?"
"I'm tired of spinning wheels. We need to interject some urgency into the equation. And I didn't tell her exactly what they were, because Agent Brown never told me." Thompson came back a half hour later with a flash drive. She handed it to Decker.
"Please understand that we want you to treat this information with the highest level of confidentiality."
"We understand that,"
said Jameson.
"And we will."
Thompson kept her gaze on Decker.
"Yeah, I'm sure you do. But I was talking about him."
Decker rose and left the room. Thompson eyed Jameson.
"How do you stand that guy? He's excellent at what he does,"
she said defensively. Thompson snorted.
"Well, he would have to be, wouldn't he, to put up with the rest of the prick."
Jameson scurried after Decker, who was striding down the hall to the exit. She caught up to him midway and fell in step beside him. She eyed the flash drive.
"Probably a lot to sort through."
"Probably."
"Hey, maybe we can have dinner with Melvin tonight. We can go out."
He didn't respond.
"Decker, I said—"
"I heard you, Alex. That sounds fine."
"Great. Say 7:30 at Cotton's. It's on 14th Street. I'll make a reservation."
"Yep. Got it." She hesitated.
"I'm sure you're glad to see Melvin."
"I am."
"I mean, after all, he is your best friend."
"Yes, he is." Jameson stuffed her hands into her pockets and marched along, her features rigid. Chapter 32. They printed off the files from the flash drive and spent the rest of the day going through them at the WFO. Bogart and Milligan had joined them.